content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. And we thank them for their generous support. Reading from Smithsonian.com, since we used up our January-February edition of readings, 10 fascinating presidential facts to impress on President's Day. That's today that we're recording this. The subheadline, Learn a New Side of the Commanders-in-Chief, from Whiskey Seances and Magazine Cover Boys. What Little-Known Facts You Could Learn About FDR, by Li Zhao. Think you've got a firm handle on the presidents? The Smithsonian Book of Presidential Trivia from Smithsonian Books just might make you question how comprehensive your head of state knowledge actually is. To commemorate the President's Day holiday, we offer some nuggets excerpted from the book that reveal a few unexpected facts about the sartorial habits, social practices, and defining characteristics of our commanders-in-chief. Number 1. George Washington owned a profitable whiskey distillery. Whiskey was one of Washington's most important business ventures at Mount Vernon. At peak production in 1799, the distillery used 5 stills and a boiler and produced 11,000 gallons of whiskey. With sales of $7,500 that year, it was perhaps the country's largest distillery. Washington's plantation manager, James Anderson, a Scottish man with distilling experience, urged him to start the venture, which was also an efficient way to use unsold ground wheat, corn, and rye. Number 2, James Madison held the first inaugural ball. Although there was a ball in 1789 to honor the election of George Washington, the first official inaugural ball did not occur until 1809, when Madison took office. Madison was sworn in at the U.S. Capitol. That evening, his wife, Dolly Madison, hosted a gala at Long's Hotel. The price of admission was $4 per ticket. 400 tickets were sold, and so began a Washington tradition. Today, the Presidential Inaugural Committee plans all the official inaugural balls. 3. Gerald Ford was a fashion model in his youth, even appearing on the cover of Cosmopolitan. Ford's first love was a woman named Phyllis Brown, a gorgeous blonde who became a fashion model. Brown persuaded Ford to invest in a modeling agency and to do some modeling himself. Together, they appeared in Ski Resort Spread of Look magazine in 1940 and on a cover of Cosmopolitan in 1942. Ultimately, the pair broke up. She wanted to continue modeling in New York, and he decided to forego the runway and begin his law career. 4. Warren Harding had the largest shoe size. Harding wore a size 14. Unfortunately, those big feet did not ensure that his administration would be on firm footing. It turned out that Harding's trusted advisors were not so trustworthy, and his presidency was riddled with scandal. He died before his term was complete, and his wife burned his potentially incriminating correspondence. However, his stately slippers and sporty golf shoes survive at the Smithsonian. 5. Presidents have received the Nobel Peace Prize, including Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama. Roosevelt received his in 1906 for his many efforts toward international peace, including his role in formulating the 1905 peace treaty between Russia and Japan. Wilson was awarded the Nobel in 1919 for founding the League of Nations after World War I. Carter was long retired from the presidency when he won the prize in 2002 for his efforts to advance human rights and advance peaceful solutions to international conflicts. Obama was honored with a Nobel in 2009 for his work towards strengthening international diplomacy and cooperation. 6. William Howard Taft became a Supreme Court Justice after his retirement. A graduate of Yale and Cincinnati Law School, Taft loved law but was unsure about politics. At the urging of his wife, Nellie, and mentor, Theodore Roosevelt, he reluctantly accepted his party's nomination for the presidency, calling the presidential campaign, quote, one of the most uncomfortable 4 months of my life. After losing the 1912 election to Woodrow Wilson, Taft served as a professor of law at Yale and was later appointed by Warren Harding as Chief Justice of the United States, a pose he considered his greatest honor. Theodore Roosevelt wore a lock of Lincoln's hair during his inauguration. Roosevelt wore a ring with a lock of Lincoln's hair in it on March 14, 1905, at his second inauguration. Roosevelt had been a longtime admirer of Lincoln and as a child had watched Lincoln's funeral procession pass by his house in New York. Roosevelt's admiration for Lincoln was reinforced later when he met John Hay, who had worked for Lincoln in the White House. Hay and Roosevelt talked about Lincoln often, and Hay gave Roosevelt the ring, knowing that Roosevelt would treasure it. Number 8. Franklin D. Roosevelt was the first president to name a woman to his cabinet. FDR named Frances Perkins as Secretary of Labor in 1933. The Mount Holyoke College graduate was a trained social worker who had worked in settlement houses in Chicago and Philadelphia. Her efforts on behalf of labor reform took on an added urgency after the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911. She served as industrial commissioner under Roosevelt when he was governor of New York. As labor secretary, Perkins established the Labor Standards Bureau and was a principal architect of the Social Security Act. John Tyler, number 9, he had 15 children. Tyler was married twice. He had 8 children with his first wife Letitia. After she died, the 54-year-old president married the 24-year-old Julia Gardner, with whom he had 7 more children. Tyler wins the prize for being the most prolific of all American presidents. And number 10, Abraham Lincoln attended seances at the White House. Lincoln's wife, Mary Lincoln, became interested in seances after their young son, Willie, died in 1862. At the White House, she engaged mediums who conducted spirit circles or ceremonies during which those who attended could communicate with their loved ones who had crossed over into the next world. Mary was eager to believe in these mediums as it made her loss somewhat bearable, and she encouraged the president to attend a few seances, which he did. It is not clear if Lincoln participated to appease his wife or out of real interest and belief. And that was by Li Zhao. She's the digital editorial intern for Smithsonian.com. She has previously written for the Boston Globe, Policy Mike, and Interview magazine. Next up, how the Grand Canyon transformed from a valueless place to a national park. Before the advent of geology as a science, the canyon was avoided. Now the popular park is celebrating its centennial year. By Stephen Pine. Few sites are as instantly recognizable, and few sites speak more fully to American nationalism. Standing on the South Rim in 1903, President Teddy Roosevelt proclaimed it one of the great sites every American should see. It's true. Every visitor today knows the Grand Canyon as a unique testimony to Earth's history and an icon of American experience. But visitors may not know why. Probably they don't know that it was big and annoying long before it was grand and inspiring. Likely they don't appreciate that the work of appreciating so strange a scene has been as astonishing as its geological sculpting. Other than a pilgrimage to a sacred site, they may not understand just what they are seeing. As Grand Canyon National Park celebrates its centennial on February 26, 2019, it's worth recalling the peculiar way the canyon became grand and what this has meant. The profitless locality. The Grand Canyon was one of the first North American natural wonders to be discovered by Europeans. In 1541, a party of the Coronado expedition under Captain Garcia Lopez de Cardenas stood at the south rim, 138 years before explorers found Niagara Falls, 167 before Yellowstone, and almost 300 before Yosemite. A group scrambled down to the river but failed to reach it and returned to announce that the buttes were much taller than the Great Tower of Seville. Then nothing. Some Coronado chroniclers did not even mention this side trip in their accounts. A Franciscan friar, Francisco Tomas Garcias, tracing tribes up the Colorado River, then visited the rim in 1776, discovered the Havasupi tribe, and departed. Fur trappers based in Taos knew of the Great Gorge, which they called the Big Canyon, and shunned it. When they guided exploring parties of the U.S. Army Corps of Topographic Engineers in search of transportation routes, they steered their expeditions away from the canyon, which offered no passage by water or land. Then, in 1857, Lieutenant Joseph C. Ives led a steamboat up the Colorado River in explicit quest of the Big Canyon. After the steamboat struck a rock and sank near Black Canyon, Ives traveled down Diamond Creek to the inner gorge, briefly touched at the south rim, and in 1861 concluded with one of the most infamous proclamations to ever emerge from an American explorer. The region is, of course, altogether valueless. After entering, there is nothing to do but leave. Ours has been the first and will doubtless be the last party of whites to visit this profitless locality. Then, 8 years later, Major John Wesley Powell descended the Colorado River through its gorges, renamed the Big Canyon as the Grand Canyon, and wrote a classic account of the view from the river. In 1882, Captain Clarence Dutton, in the first monograph published by the new U.S. Geological Survey, wrote an equally classic account, this time from the rim. Something had changed. Mostly it was the advent of geology as a science with broad cultural appeal. The Grand Canyon might be valueless as a corridor of transport, but it was a wonderland for the new science. It helped enormously that artists were drawn to landscapes, of which the canyon seemed both unique and operatic. Used by Powell and Dutton, Thomas Moran and William Henry Holmes transformed a supremely visual scene into paint and ink. Before Powell and Dutton, the Grand Canyon was a place to avoid. Now it was a marvel to admire. 20 years later, Teddy Roosevelt stepped off a train at the South Rim and added nationalism to the mix by declaring it a natural wonder, absolutely unparalleled throughout the rest of the world. It was an astonishing reversal of perception. The geologic mystery of the canyon is how the south-trending Colorado River made a sudden turn westward to carve its way cross-grained through four plateaus. This is also more or less what happened culturally. Intellectuals cut against existing aesthetics to make a place that looked like nothing, pastorals or alpine mountains, into a compelling spectacle. Unlike most great features, the Grand Canyon is invisible until you stand on its rim. You aren't drawn to it as to a river's source or a mountain's peak. You have to seek it out and then cope with its visual revelation. It simply and suddenly is. So it appeared to Western civilization. As Dutton pointed out, the canyon, while the sublimest thing on earth, was a great innovation in our modern ideas of scenery, and appreciating a scene so alien to European sensibilities demanded the invention of a new aesthetic. It required its own unique canon of appreciation. The Grand Canyon stood alone. It still does, which makes its standing as a natural wonder paradoxical. Yet, in two ways, the canyon has strengthened both the aesthetics of landscape and its preservation. First, it added an appreciation for exposed rock, gorges, and earth colors to the traditional focus of the bucolic, the alpine, and the green. It made it possible to value the larger setting of the Colorado Plateau, which contained the Grand Canyon, but otherwise lay to the margins of American settlement and economy. This region now has the highest density of parks and monuments of any physiographic province in the country. And there's a map, they call it the Colorado Plateau's province, and the Grand Canyon is shown, but there's also Grand Canyon National Park, there's Lake Mead National Recreation Area, Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument, Walnut Canyon National Monument, several national historic sites, and just lots of things. Canyon Lands, and I believe that's in Utah. High Plateaus of Utah, Capitol Reef National Park, and I've been to several of these. In the Uinta Basin, Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park, and then at the top of the map, definitely in Utah, is Dinosaur National Monument. All this surrounds the Grand Canyon. And also, the Grand Canyon contributed to the rise of post-war environmentalism through debates in the 1960s over proposed dams. The canyon had enough cultural cachet that advocates could argue successfully to protect it. Slightly upriver, Glen Canyon, by contrast, lacked that heritage and got dammed. I think that by that they mean a dam was built. Yet the Grand Canyon sits awkwardly in more contemporary preservationist thinking. The larger thrust has been to expand beyond geologic monumentalism, so typical of early parks, and incorporate living landscapes rich in biodiversity and unique habitats. But the Grand Canyon is a geological spectacle. If it contained nothing alive within its immense amphitheater, it would still retain its cultural power. Its scale is so vast, other than flooding it above the inner gorge, it's hard to imagine what people might do to permanently alter it. Yet it is possible to spoil the canyon experience. What it takes is an obscured sky or a visually confused viewpoint or social noise that distracts from the quiet calm of individual vision. The Grand Canyon's great impact still derives from the sudden shock of seeing it all without filters or foreground. The rim just falls away. The canyon is there instantly and insistently. It's an individual epiphany, unmeditated. That sensation is what must survive for the Grand Canyon to work its cultural alchemy. Threats to it are not new, but they have evolved from mining, dams, and industrial tourism to the compounding insults of an Anthropocene era. Not sure what that means. Still, as Roosevelt understood, the Grand Canyon testifies to that most fundamental of all needs. Leave it as it is. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. Keep it, he urged, for your children, your children's children, and for all who come after you. We can do that in spite of climate change, invasive species, a feckless global economy, dysfunctional politics, and a national attention span for which sound bites take too long. We can leave it as it is. This article was originally published on The Conversation. Stephen Pine is an emeritus professor of the School of Life Sciences, at Arizona State University. And if I may add my two cents worth, I've been to the Grand Canyon several times, and it really looks different at different times of the day, depending on how the light hits it. Very interesting place, and something everyone should experience. National Air and Space Museum says, "Pardon our renovation, but come anyway." In need of a new facade, the museum undergoes top-to-bottom change, bringing state-of-the-art technology and 21st century stories into its exhibitions. By Jane Recker, R-E-C-K-E-R. In 1976, the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum building opened on the National Mall to much fanfare and celebration, quickly becoming one of the most visited museums in the world. The opening was part of the nation's bicentennial celebrations, and the construction of the sprawling, blocks-long building was completed on time and on budget. But the cost-saving measures enacted to meet budgetary requirements have not weathered the test of time. In 2011, after a 5.8 magnitude earthquake rocked Washington, D.C., investigators assessing the damages found that cracking and warping of the museum's 1.5-inch thick walls appear to have compromised the building's HVAC system. Covered walkways were put up for fear of falling chunks of marble. The museum's new director, Ellen Stofan, NASA's former chief scientist, has noted that much-loved museum was in need of attention. "We're falling apart," she told the Washington Post. "In a massive 7-year project, the entire facade will be replaced, a project that calls for half the museum to be closed at any given time. But visitors will still be able to see parts of the museum's galleries. Keeping the museum open means the project will take longer," says Elizabeth Wilson, the museum's assistant director of advancement, "despite the inconveniences both visitors and construction workers will experience during the renovation period." "We're staying open on purpose," Wilson says. "This would be easier and cheaper if we shut down and redid it. But we want to be open for the American people, so it's going to be a bit messier. But for all the people, these once-in-a-lifetime trips, we want to make sure we can accommodate that. Visitors will find sidewalk and street lane closures along Jefferson Drive, 7th and 4th Streets, and Independence Avenue. Pedestrians will have to cross other streets. In January, gallery closures on the west side of the building, including the exhibitions America by Air, Sea Air Operations, Military Unmanned Aerial Vehicles, Golden Age of Flight, World War II Aviation, Jet Aviation, and Legend, Memory, and the Great War in the Air got underway. Wilson stresses the museum will share as much as they can with the public, despite the monumental logistics of moving around more than 5,000 artifacts during the renovations. Many will be transferred to the Air and Space Museum's other location, the Stephen F. Udar Hazy Center near Dulles Airport in Chantilly, Virginia. There they will either go on display or undergo restoration in Hazy's spacious Mary Baker Engen Restoration Center, where the public can watch the work being done from an overhead mezzanine. Chief Curator Peter Jacob says the museum will offer special events and programming this year to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 lunar landing. In addition to bringing a number of Apollo astronauts to the museum to tell their stories, significant artifacts and Neil Armstrong's spacesuit will be pulled from storage. Incorporating technology into exhibition storytelling is one of the biggest goals in redesigning the galleries, Wilson says. The project aims to be flexible when it comes to technology. Wilson says they're letting the storytelling choose the technology, not the other way around. "Our director wants every child who comes into this museum to see themselves throughout the museum," she says. "The storytelling should really focus on who the people are behind these objects and tell a really diverse stories, not just the pilot, but who built the airplane and who worked on the assembly line." it will be 3 years before visitors will get to see the first fruits of these labors, and 7 years until the final product is unveiled. When this is all done, we're going to be introducing these American heroes to the country, Wilson says. And I don't just mean Neil Armstrong. I mean everybody who's pulled off this uniquely American triumph with flight and aviation. Check for updates on the renovation, visitor information, and see a preview of the new plans on Ignite Tomorrow, the mission to transform the National Air and Space Museum website. Jane Recker is a writer for Smithsonian.com and the Chicago Sun-Times. She is currently at Northwestern University studying journalism and opera. And we'll fill the last minute and a half with some feedback on the discussion page of Smithsonian Magazine. Remembering the rebellion, I found the cost of the Confederacy incredibly one-sided. To lump all those linked to the Confederacy as promoting a white agenda is wrong. Today's values should not be applied to people who lived in the past. Southern states have a right to preserve their history, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Articles like this do more to promote hatred and division than bring us together, says Selena Levitt of Wildwood, Missouri. And Daniel S. Pokorny of La Grande, Oregon, says, history is just that, history. People should learn from history, not tear down and destroy the symbols of it. And Daryl Enger of Chandler, Arizona, says, as long as our leaders fail to address racism, which is not limited to the South, taxpayers will continue to support what is ultimately a white nationalist cause. Unlike Germany, which acknowledged its horrific history, we are mired in sentimentality for a past that never existed. And another writer, Daniel Winner, legal counsel for the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes of the Fort Peck Indian Reservation, writes about the article Political Animal in the November 2018 edition. He says that article ignores the hardships of transferring bison to the tribes. The tribes have constructed a quarantine facility to return brucellosis negative buffalo to tribal lands and restore their historical connections with American Indians. But the state of Montana, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, and the livestock industry have obstructed this effort. The government took buffalo from American Indians, and now it refuses to give them back. And there's our cue to wrap things up for this week. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.